ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Ah, yes, Christmas time. For many of us, a season of feasting. And it comes with such a distinct and delightful array of comestibles. Don't know about you, but I've been getting into the mince pies since November. The turkey is ordered for the big day. The pudding was done and wrapped 18 months ago. It's a little family tradition there. We'll have a spread of fresh fruit on the table too. You know what? Every one of those foods is mentioned in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Little book that was a runaway publishing smash more than 180 years ago. No wonder our Christmas table mainstays often feel timeless. Although the feasts of Christmases past included some fairly unfamiliar elements as well.
One of the very first immigrants to South Australia recorded that she had parrot and ham pie for Christmas. Parrot pie went on to become quite an Australian thing. In fact, it was even mentioned in one of the Mrs. Beaton cookbooks as an Australian dish.
Was that a Rosella or lorikeet gracing the Christmas tables of old? I'd go for a cockatoo every time. Our food rituals evolve alongside changing tastes, changing agriculture, changing geography. Dickens doesn't mention the obligatory pavlova or White Christmas, so often part of the Australian spread these days. And for many Australians, that deeply Anglophile Dickensian feast is, well, it's never felt like the familiar food of Yuletide.
We don't have Christmas hams, we have Christmas lasagnas and Christmas pasta al forno and meatballs, and it's just any other Sunday lunch on a larger scale.
So our Christmas traditions are richly varied, but with history behind every dish. And the origins of the Northern Hemisphere's winter feasting, well, those origins are ancient.
Our ecclesiastical year, our kind of Christmas year, is very much pinned to an agricultural year. You know, this idea of fasting and then feasting is really to enable animals to keep on kind of reproducing and feeding us.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science, history, and Christmas collide. This week, from parrot to panettone, the many feasts of Christmas.
The long story of Christmas is very much about class, but it's very much also about other kinds of status. So, you know, are you a Catholic? Are you a Protestant? Are you a Puritan? Because if you're a Puritan, you're going to really try and dissuade people from celebrating Christmas. Whereas if you are a Catholic, you know, from the kind of pre-Reformation times, Christmas is much more about a kind of long 12 days. It's much more spiritual. It's much more to do with kind of your church going, your kind of inner life. My name is Pen Vogler. I'm a food historian, and I'm the author of Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain. And then you start to kind of move towards this idea of Christmas that we're kind of a bit more familiar with, where it's much more of a celebration. There's an old-fashioned way of doing it, where the lord and lady, or the kind of senior person in a village, you know, or the senior person who kind of owns this big house, would invite everybody, the servants, the friends, the relations, the poor relations. They'd all come and they'd have a big sort of celebration on Christmas Eve or Christmas or something. And there's this also this idea that if you're the landowner, you make sure your tenants have some meat for Christmas. And it might just be a chicken or a couple of rabbits or something. It might be a bullock's heart. You know, it might not be the most kind of glamorous thing. But there's this idea that Christmas is a sort of fairly rural celebration, and there are chains of responsibility, which might be ignored the rest of the year, but they mean something at Christmas. And so there's this kind of class idea of kind of, you know, looking after each other. And then it begins to break down at the beginning of the 19th century. It breaks down for all kinds of reasons, but one of the things I find really resonant is that in the 1830s, there's this new poor law, which is to try and get people to kind of stop shirking. And it means you put them in the, you know, in the workhouse, and you make it so grim they just do everything they can to leave. And it's a horrible law. People hate it. Dickens writes about it. And one of the ways they make it grim is to say, right, we're not going to let anybody have Christmas dinner anymore. You know, so there's this old idea that you give a charitable Christmas dinner to folk. You might roast a whole ox and get your cook to cook hundreds and hundreds of plum puddings, and everybody has a bit of roast beef and plum pudding. And then they decide in the workhouses they ban it. And there's this kind of big movement to kind of bring Christmas back around that time, about the early 19th century.
As you mentioned, I mean, originally Christmas was, of course, the 12 days of Christmas. When does the feasting settle on December the 25th?
That's a very good question. If you look in sort of Tudor times, you know, in kind of the Reformation, even later in the Restoration, it's still the kind of 12 days. And then when we become more of an industrial country, a more kind of a capitalist country, you know, there's this idea that the 12 days, you know, people are kind of tapping their watches and saying, you know, when are you guys going to get back to work? So the 25th has always been Christmas Day, but the feasting starts to settle more on that day, and then the 12th night gets kind of pushed away, I would say, in the kind of middle of the 19th century.
As you pointed out, that meats are a fundamental part of the Christmas food celebration. Interesting fact that I've learned from you is that the first turkey, a thing that we now associate very much with Christmas, the first turkey doesn't arrive in England until the 1520s, in Tudor times.
Yeah, when we discovered this whole new world called America.
With turkeys.
With turkeys, and we think they come from Turkey, so we call them turkeys. It's ridiculous. No, that's true, but the meat is always very much part of that winter celebration. I mean, even going back to pagan times.
Well, it's a time of slaughter, isn't it? We're in the middle of winter. We have to thin the herd.
You have to thin the herd because there's not enough grain to go around for you and all your animals. And if your animals, you know, they're fat and luscious on their kind of all that kind of autumn food, that's the time to slaughter them. You know, eat up all that lovely fresh meat, pork pies, all that sort of stuff. And then you have to stop eating them at Lent to let them reproduce for the next year, or you're not going to have the next crop of kind of chickens and sheep and cows and all the rest of it.
Now, you make a very compelling argument that the Christmas as we know it is a thing pretty much defined by Charles Dickens.
It's interesting, isn't it? So this point when people are kind of going, oh, you know, Christmas is being sort of squandered, you know, we're not celebrating it in the way that we used to. What Charles Dickens does in A Christmas Carol, which was published in 1843, is he kind of anchors our Christmas dinner to the day. So all those foods, you know, the Christmas pudding, goose and turkey that we'll talk about, were sort of celebratory foods for Christmas, but also for New Year, for Twelfth Night, for Harvest Festival. And the Christmas Carol is so fantastically successful that he sort of, he creates this kind of Christmas dinner for this kind of new kind of people, aspiring, hardworking, urban poor, definitely urban, you know, and it's a family celebration, not, you know, there's not really any servants around. It's not a whole village. That's what he's showing us in A Christmas Carol. And it resonates with so many people. And that's what we start to think of as Christmas dinner.
It's the modern household, isn't it? I mean, and that's a novelty.
It's pretty much a novelty, yes. But you can also see some of the foods that are changing at the time.
Well, there's a goose.
There's a goose, and this is what working people ate. The goose, we now, I don't know about it in Australia, but in England, goose is a sort of posh thing. You know, it's quite a fancy thing to have for Christmas dinner, whereas a turkey is kind of, oh, everybody has it. And in the Victorian times, absolutely the opposite. You know, Mrs. Beaton says, you know, something like, Christmas would not be Christmas with the middle classes of this empire without the turkey. So she's very definitely kind of putting it in its kind of social place. And you can see in A Christmas Carol that the poor Cratchits are going to have a goose. Then Scrooge, when he gets reformed and decides he's going to look after them, he buys them a turkey. And it's big and it's meaty and it's much more of a kind of middle class meat.
And the Cratchits have also prepared their own plum pudding for the occasion.
Yeah, the Christmas pudding is interesting, isn't it? Because again, it's like that idea that Charles Dickens is kind of pinning this food, is anchoring this kind of menu to Christmas Day. Mm. And in A Christmas Carol, he just talks about plum pudding. Nobody really calls it Christmas pudding until one of the first recipes, if not the first, is in Eliza Acton's cookbook in 1845, which was 2 years later, and she gives you a recipe for the author's Christmas pudding. And I don't know if she means herself, the author, or if she means Dickens, the author.
Oh, it's interesting.
It's a fun little culinary mystery, because we know she liked Dickens. We know that she read and admired Dickens. And then this pudding starts to be called Christmas pudding, and very fine it is too.
And is it a fairly stable recipe?
It's an incredibly stable recipe. Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's all the stuff that's, you know, very rich stuff. Plum basically means the best stuff. It's like, you know, the plum job. It doesn't actually mean plum. You know, and if you see something about sugar plums from old books, it usually means actually a sugared almond, not a plum. It just means a good thing. And yeah, it's a very stable recipe. I used Eliza Acton's recipe for my Christmas pudding. It's light. It's, well, lightish, you know, but it's very delicious. And I think now it's really interesting. People keep on doing surveys in England going, oh, you know, Christmas pudding, it's falling out of favour. Everybody wants the chocolate log or whatever it is, you know. And actually, I think people are going to go, this is practically a health food. Look at all the fruit and the fibre and the natural sugar in this thing, you know. I think probably Christmas pudding is going to come back into our Christmas repertoires.
Penn Vogler, author of Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain, and the cookbook Christmas with Dickens. From ABC Radio National, this is Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. Well, a Christmas pudding renaissance. Well, that would be music to the ears of Australian fruit growers. As far back as the 1920s, our local dried fruit producers were making a big push to become one of the world's foremost suppliers of this essential element of Christmas pud.
The Australian Dried Fruit Association were very keen to promote their dried fruit, and they actually organised this event in London called the Empire Christmas Pudding. And it was a giant Christmas pudding that was put on a truck and paraded around from Australia House through the streets of London as a way to encourage the Brits to buy Australian dried fruit for their puddings.
Jan O'Connell is a writer and the founder of the Australian Food History Timeline. It's a website that traces the history of Australian food since colonisation. Let's begin with Jan's own memories of Christmas dinner.
Well, my Christmas was a very Anglo one, I suppose. It was with the extended family always, originally with my mother's mother and all the Relleys. It started off in the morning before we left our house to gather. There were always a couple of drinks. The ladies would have Pimm's sometimes.
Oh.
Yeah, brandy and dry, they were and the men always beer. That was the way it was. And then we had pretty strict menu control. Lunchtime was the big meal. Christmas dinner was always at lunchtime. And it was always turkey. It was pickled pork. Essential condiments like bread sauce with the turkey, applesauce for the pickled pork, and the roast vegetables and so on, and then followed by Christmas pudding. Everybody kind of went into a rather somnolent state after that, except the kids. When we were little, there was a pianola, and we all used to adjourn to the room with the pianola and pedal away and sing all these old songs like Did Your Mother Come From Ireland and songs that I still know some of the lyrics for.
Let's go back, even before your early family Christmases, go back to the beginning of Christmas in this country, which of course starts in 1788.
That's right. But as I understand it, the first Christmas wasn't particularly exciting. Most of the accounts seem to talk more about the church services and what the preacher did than what people ate.
I believe somebody stole some rum, but that's perhaps not unexpected.
I think so. And also people in those early days stole some pigs. I found a lovely story from 1803. There was a little note in the Sydney Gazette that a number of pigs had unaccountably gone missing just prior to Christmas, and that no doubt they'd be honoured guests at Christmas lunchtime. Yeah.
And on we go. And
I mean, Australia has a particular climate, and the place in which our Christmas traditions were born has a particular climate, but we seem to have set that to one side.
Yes, I think various people during history have objected to it. In 1872, there was a Scottish-born squatter and photographer whose name was John Hunter Kerr, and he lamented the heaviness of the traditional Christmas pudding. And he had a memoir called Glimpses of Life in Victoria by a resident, and he suggested that the pudding would be better replaced by some cooler and more seasonable dainty dish.
I wonder what that might be.
Well, it couldn't have been pavlova because it hadn't been invented by then.
Who did invent pavlova?
I actually credit the Kiwis with it, although they called it pavlova cake. So whether that makes a difference, I don't know. But the recipe was identical pretty much.
But it has become part of the seasonal thinking in this country.
Yeah, well, we always had pavlova for Christmas in the evening. After the big hot Christmas lunch, it was always cold ham, cold turkey, salads and pavlova.
Something to cleanse the palate.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
This is the funny thing about Christmas in this country, that as much as that traditional, shall we call it Dickensian Christmas, of the roast bird of some description and all those trimmings, as much as that feels wildly inappropriate, it's a thing that we stick to rather gamely. Yeah, you know, we're very attached to it. We know it's wrong. We know it's absurd to be doing this when it's 110 in the shade, but nonetheless.
Well, I think there's an association, a strong association between certain foods and our social rituals. Mm. So I think it's more about the social ritual than the food itself in a way. I mean, it's not quite the same as Italians and Greeks, for example, always have lamb for Easter, but that has a more religious symbolism, whereas I can't see that the turkey has a special symbolism. I think it's just a cultural thing that we hark back to our original attachment as kind of Anglo immigrants.
One of the things that the modern Australian might turn to is seafood. Yeah. This has increasingly become, and for obvious reasons, I guess, a Christmas feast.
Yeah, well, most of us live around the coast one way or another, and I guess that's not surprising that we've started to adopt seafood. For instance, the Sydney Fish Market, they have a marathon that starts on the 23rd of December at 5 a.m. and goes up until 5 p.m. on Christmas Eve, non-stop, overnight. And this year they're expecting to sell more than 350 tonnes of seafood to more than 100,000 customers, and that includes 120 tonnes of prawns and almost 70,000 dozen oysters.
I'm trying to imagine 120-something tonnes of prawns.
It's that's pretty unimaginable. You wouldn't want to be buried under them.
Yes. Now, we do have some, apart from the parrot pie, some things which are particularly Australian for this time of year. There is the eponymous White Christmas. What is that?
Oh, White Christmas is, I feel, a rather disgusting kind of sweetmeat that's made from rice bubbles, kofa, dried fruits and powdered milk, I think, are the main ingredients. It's an Australian invention. In fact, kofa is an Australian thing. Kofa arrived as a byproduct of Lever Brothers Sunlight Soap. They had coconut plantations in the Pacific to extract the oil, and they were making soap from the oil. And of course, coconut oil being edible, once a German scientist invented this hydrogenation process, they could solidify the coconut oil and it would serve as a kind of substitute for butter in cooking.
The race was then on to find things to make with it. Hello, chocolate crackles.
Chocolate crackles, definitely. And, you know, cooking with kofa became quite big in the 1930s. And that's the earliest recipe I could find for White Christmas was in 1939.
One of my father's favourites at Christmas was a bottle of, and I despise this drink, sparkling Shiraz.
Ah, yes. Or as we used to call it, sparkling Burgundy. And that's actually a distinctive Australian style of wine. We can trace it back to the 1870s, the very earliest ones, but in the 1890s was kind of when Great Western started making what they called sparkling Burgundy. And it's a traditional accompaniment to roast turkey on Christmas Day.
It has a body, can go with that strong fowl.
Yes, indeed. One of the interesting things I found was that when they inaugurated the very first lift in Alice Springs, they inaugurated it by sprinkling the lift with sparkling Burgundy. This was in 1956.
Australia, where else would you live? So the Australian Christmas, it's still there is this resilient strand of traditionality, of that Anglo tradition is very strong.
Yeah, well, it's not just Anglo. I mean, Italians and Greeks and, you know, a lot of European immigrants or people from those backgrounds, they have their own Christmas traditions. I've got a Greek friend and they still put lamb and chicken on the spit for Christmas. And, of course, you go into Coles and you'll find panettone everywhere.
Yes.
And that's a very strongly Italian thing, but it's not now limited to people of Italian background. So I think our Christmas traditions have broadened out a bit.
Jan O'Connell, founder of the Australian Food History Timeline. And she's right to point out that, well, just as Anglo-Australians might yearn for mince pies and turkey, Australians from other backgrounds maintain their own traditions. Italian Australians, as she mentions, have their own array of Christmas foods. But there's one Australian favourite it seems we all agree on.
There'd be the cannolis and the sfinches and the crema al limone and all that stuff there. And then there'd always be a pavlova.
Yeah, a pav.
There's always a pav there.
Yeah, they do a pav.
Yeah, they always had
a pav. They're throwing a pav. Because it was easier. The pav was just get the pav out, throw cream on it, put some kiwi fruit and strawberries.
Done. Bang. Ready to go.
Food was central to the home lives of the comedy troupe Sushi Mango. So much so that they've recently published their first cookbook. It's called Eat, Mama Knows Best. And it includes recipes you'll be sure to find on an Italian Christmas spread. They're speaking with Every Bite producer Kim Jurek.
I'm Joe.
I'm Carlo.
And I'm Andrew.
And we are Sushi Mango.
We would have pasta every day of the week, generally, but you would have just normal pasta. You know, you'd have your macaroni, you'd have your spaghetti, your tagliatelle, all that kind of stuff. But for, like, events, they would whip out the lasagna, you know, and Christmas was just the lasagna, pasta forno, it was, yeah. So, and like Andrew said, there was copious amounts of it. You know, it was just done with that extra special care for that day, you know, because they knew everyone was watching.
Yeah. From when to when? Like, run us through a typical schedule on Christmas Day.
The aunties and mums and nonnas, they would all meet very early and prepare. So they would get there, you know, like 8 a.m. or, you know, 7 a.m.
8 a.m, more 6.
All right, 6 a.m. And then they would, you know, guests would start rocking up around about 11. And then it was just you'd say hello for, maybe 2-3 hours because there was about 600 people there. Lunch would come around, you'd eat, and you'd spend a good 2 hours on that meal.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd sleep. Everyone would do siesta and there'd be a little bit of a sort of a calmer period. And then everyone would just, you know, around 4:30, they'd start reheating everything again and we'd eat again. And then we'd, you know, we'd have a bit of coffee and cake and all that kind of stuff and the fruit and everything like that. And then late night, again, it would be like picking at leftovers at about 10:30, you know, 11 o'clock, everyone would just start sort of eating whatever was left over.
Just like a little after dinner mint. It was lasagna.
I'm wondering, you painted that picture of all the nonnas and aunties getting up early to cook. Was there politics over who cooked what?
Yes, in my family it was. I'm sure it was like that with most. Like my auntie would bring the lasagna. My other auntie would bring a big bowl of rice cooked in a special Sicilian way, and my other auntie would bring the parmigiana, the eggplant parmigiana. Someone would bring the sweets because they all believed that they had the best. Mine is the best one. You know, that was their mentality. Yeah.
Sometimes it'd be like one auntie would bring lasagna and then another auntie would bring it. There was a miscommunication.
Yes, that happened a few times.
You know, and there would be like this, oh, who's eating more of which lasagna? Mm. Like who, which one are people getting attracted to more?
Yep.
And there was this unsaid rivalry going on for the day between whose lasagna was better.
Yeah, it was a Mexican standoff between pastas. Yeah.
And were there some foods that only came out at Christmas, I wonder? I know, Joe, there's a recipe for some Christmas cookies that you are a big fan of.
We called them cassatelli, right? But I think that in different parts of Italy, the same name for different biscuits, some do it with ricotta and so forth, but this one's with crushed almonds and then it's got strega, like a liqueur in it, and then they mix it overnight and yada, yada, yada. My grandma used to make that every Christmas. And the reason why is it's not easy to make. It takes a couple of days because, you know, you got to let the almonds and the liqueur sit. And so my grandma used to make batches of them for everyone, and then she'd make a little batch for me on the side, you know what I mean? Not tell your brother.
Yeah.
You know? And then
they were
just beautiful.
How about panettone? Was that a thing?
Bought, yes. We never made it. We get it. You wouldn't have to buy it because everyone would bring you one. You'd have 35 panettone brought to you Christmas morning.
Yeah.
By the end of February, they'll be re-gifted to someone else. So that's we didn't make panettone. You guys make panettone?
No, we never did. I mean, yeah, we had other things like crostoli, which was another type of biscuit.
They're in the book.
They're
too.
In the book. And Sicilian donuts, which are called sfinci.
I think there's a crema al limone in there. Which
Mum used to make that for Christmas all the time, which is crema al limone, which is lemon cream. You know, it's almost like a custard, a lemon custard.
There's one in there called spicchiatelle, which is like a gingerbread. They'd make an appearance on Easter and Christmas on special occasions.
What about the Gigi as well?
Hey, the Gigi, yes.
Yeah,
the Gigi.
With the vinacotto, which is, what's vinacotto in English?
They just call it vinacotto.
Is it vinacotto?
Yes.
Oh. Vinacotto.
Yes. Well, not too many sleeps now, so Buon Natale.
Buon Natale,
Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
So now it's over to you. Goose or lasagna, turkey or prawn. But whatever the menu, the key feast is one of kindness. As Bob Cratchit put it, a Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us. And of course, in Christmas Carol, little Tiny Tim has the last words. God bless us, everyone. And we know what comes next, the tucking in. Enjoy. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every bite tells a story. And thanks to our guests, Sushi Mango, Jan O'Connell and Penn Vogler. And that brings a festive close to our inaugural season of Every Bite. From next week, we'll be revisiting some of our very favourite episodes from our past year together. And if you have foodies in your life, ideal Christmas gift. Let them know about the show. These next few weeks, revisiting our very best episodes, will be a great time for new listeners to get acquainted. You can hear us ABC Radio National or any time at all on the ABC Listen app. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jirik. A Merry Christmas to you. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.